of May Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's May.
Good evening. This is May Brussel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 482, March the 1st, 1981. I have a whole section of articles to share with you this evening, but of course in the 1 hour it's going to be impossible to cover some of these stories. I'll get back to them in the future, but I just want to run them off for you quickly so you'll know that I'm aware that they're in the news and I will cover them later. One has to do with an article, an interview I did with the Soho News in New York City in 1975. I warned the people when I talked to the Elgin Theater about Ronald Reagan being the Fuhrer, the Nazification of America, and so forth. I reread the article this last week when I was answering a letter, and it was so pertinent to what's happening today, and it was based on three lectures I gave at the Elgin in New York 6 years ago that later I want to go into some of those details with you. I also want to go into the war of the words between Ronald Reagan and Mr. General Haig and the Soviet Union, and an editorial that the Soviet Union is winning the war of the words because they can throw up to the world our oppression of people in the Philippines and in Korea and Chile and all over the world, putting people down for the ruling elite. And it's hard to fight back because they're throwing at us evidence that we can't deny. It's an interesting article. And I mentioned it several weeks on the program, the war of the words, Ronald Reagan attacking the Soviet Union as murderers and terrorists, and Haig doing the same. And then the Soviet Union responding, well, you've said enough now, come visit us. And then General Haig replying this week, that's an interesting offer. The Soviet Union does have enough on the crimes that we've committed and the murders that we have committed to beckon Haig and Reagan to the Soviet Union, which they would not like to do, of course, just as they had Richard Nixon going to China and Russia. I want to talk about the book Alternative 3. Leslie Watkins was on KABC last night from London, confirming his worst fears when he wrote Alternative 3. He will be on KABC 2 weeks from last Saturday night. That's about March the 13th or 14th for people on the West Coast talking from London. And I want to go into the Moon Treaty. That story was in the Long Beach papers today. This is the person who wrote the book Alternative 3 that I did many tapes on broadcast about. You can get those cassettes if you want, and I'll update you on the intent of the United States to build space stations for genocide. I want to go into the problems in El Salvador. One of the members of the Senate who's pushing to cut off money from Nicaragua and El Salvador, push the military junta, is Senator Lugar from Indiana. And I want to go into material that came up at the time of Watergate, that he took over $1 million of Richard Nixon's money and put in Swiss banks with Nazi war criminals. There's an article this month in Penthouse, March 1981, by Tom Gervasi, "The Russians Are Not Coming," about the bankrupting of this country by putting money into arms, and who profits by throwing this story at us over and over again that the Russians are coming. There's another article I don't want you to miss until I get to discussing it with you on the air. It's in Penthouse also, the same issue, called 36 Hours at Santa Fe. I did many tapes and radio broadcasts on the killing of the 33 people in the Santa Fe, New Mexico prisons. And this article goes into the fact that the prison chief who was brought in 1 month before the murders there, his name is Adolf Saenz, S-A-E-N-Z-E. He's from the CIA. He's from Uruguay. He trained Mitrione. That's Jim Jones' buddy from Richmond, Indiana. He had trained the police in Uruguay in killing, in torture, in diabolical tortures that I will list. And he moved to Santa Fe, New Mexico, the month before the prison riots when the 33 informers were killed. And 2 months before that took place, I had warned about Raymond Precunier in California, who was in charge of our prisons and prison riots and racism and narcotics, gun running in our prison, and assassinations in the California prisons. And Precunier was at Santa Fe, New Mexico before and after the riots. Also in gallery this month is a terrible article of disinformation. I was hoping it would be good. It's by Richard Russell, called "The Man Who Had a Contract to Kill Lee Harvey Oswald." The story is a bunch of BS. It has no validity at all, but I would like to analyze it for you and show you what is wrong with it. There's an introduction by Bernard Fensterwald of the CIA, and Russell, of course, is a writer for Mr. Annenberg's TV Guide. I also want to discuss the TV movies such as The Bunker and Evita Peron. Evita on this last week. It's absolutely terrible that the TV is used as our only source of history, that people growing up will have these movies to play back, and they are not true history. They're worse than watered down. They're distortions of the actual truth, and there's something that should be done in allowing these kinds of stories, such as the Manson family, the SLA, the Lee Harvey Oswald, and now it's the Evita Peron and the Bunker, the Attica shooting. These things are terrible, but these two in particular I want to go into because I've been stressing so much the taking of money from Nazi Germany and turning into narcotics, gun running, and financing the Fourth Reich, which we're experiencing now, and genocide of Third World people. And the Evita Peron bank account was a repository of $80 million to escalate this, and as soon as she was dead, the money was unleashed and handed out to these people. And I want to go at length into the book Best Evidence by David Lifton. I've been getting letters and calls about that. I did a review for it of the book for a national magazine, and the reason I don't want to do it on KLRB or on other radio broadcasts is because I assume that because they wanted me to do it and they paid me well for it, they want some kind of an exclusive on it. But the gist of Best Evidence is that is not a good book. The evidence that he refers to as the best evidence, the body of John Kennedy, was allegedly by David Lifton cut up at the time of autopsy and the wounds rearranged so that it looked like the bullet holes came from the back so they could blame Lee Harvey Oswald for the murder. And all of that was supposed to have taken place from the time Kennedy was at Parkland Hospital dead until the first autopsy at Bethesda Hospital in Maryland. And David Lifton doesn't name a single person. He denies that the very people that in one part of the book he says were in autopsy room one could have done it in room two. He doesn't say where it took place. He doesn't say who did it or how they did it. And I think it's a lot of malarkey. If you're going to kill the President of the United States, certainly anybody in on a conspiracy doesn't have to alter his body or his flesh or any part of him surgically within a 20 or 30 minute time period with many people watching. All you have to do to change the course of history is have a good fountain pen and alter the papers later. Dr. Hume could write one autopsy report, and 2 days later he burned it. He can call the doctors of Parkland who said there were entry holes, and he said, no, those were exit holes. He can have a drawing of where the hole was on John Kennedy's body and tell an artist where it was, and the Warren Commission didn't ask for photographs taken of John Kennedy's body. And then a few years later, they raise the hole up and redraw it and say, oh, no, it's a few inches higher. So all you need to change the course of history is a fountain pen. And I don't believe that anybody would get that involved in altering a body surgically when you have so much control over the situation. And another point I do want to make on it is that if there was a conspiracy to kill Kennedy, there also was a conspiracy to kill the Patsy who would be blamed for the murder. Kennedy was killed on a Friday, and Lee Harvey Oswald was killed on Sunday. With Oswald killed, there wouldn't be a trial. So why would anybody, 20 minutes after Kennedy was dead, start surgically altering his body when they never could dream there'd be anything like a Warren Commission that was so big? They were supposed to have a Texas Court of Inquiry with Robert Story of the State Department and Leon Jaworski of the CIA. So Kennedy was dead, and as soon as the doctors left the autopsy room immediately, the embalmers were there putting the fluid in him, and he went to the East Room of the White House, and then he was buried, and the chances of exhuming him were practically impossible. And even if they had a prestigious commission and a staff of hundreds and years to work and millions of dollars, they still altered history. They didn't ask for the autopsy x-rays. They didn't ask for the photographs of the body. They threw the brains away. Why do you have to slice the brains with a hatchet, as he implied, or sew the skull together, or find pieces of the skull and patch it up in front of 20 or 30 people when you're going to throw the brains out? They were never seen or examined for ballistic evidence. So the Warren Commission and the Justice Department and J. Edgar Hoover and the CIA and the Pentagon could do anything worth the body they wanted as far as history grows. They just take Kennedy's body. They did an autopsy. They buried the guy. Then they wrote their history and rewrote their history and forced witnesses to say the impossible, or Arlene Specter fabricated this one bullet theory that went through John Kennedy and through John Connally, which Connally even denied. So the point is, why go to all the bother of double coffins, of a body bag versus a sheet, and double ambulances or three ambulances? And the whole book is 700 pages, which proves that you can write 700 pages and not say anything. He absolves everybody at the end of not having any complicity, no army and so forth. And David Lifton had two burning obsessions. One was to prove to the Warren Commission that they were honorable people, but they made an error because they didn't have all the proper parts of Kennedy's corpse when they did their work. And the second thing he wanted to prove was that all the critics, he keeps referring to the critics, were off base because they based their conclusions on a body that was surgically altered before burial. Well, I don't think David Lifton is in a position to instruct John J. McCloy of Chase Manhattan and the CIA, or Alan Dulles, the director of the CIA, and the entire CIA staff of secretaries and so forth, that they missed any points. The problem with the Warren Commission was they didn't even ask for any evidence or physical evidence to solve the crime. They never called the right witnesses. They didn't use what they had. They didn't use the photographs of Kennedy's body or the x-rays of his body. They used third-hand drawings. The commission was cropped from the very beginning. And by David Lifton agreeing to say the commission was innocent, newborn babes in the arms of innocents who only were misdirected because some devils in an autopsy room surgically altered the corpse of the president, is beyond belief. I won't say any more about the book until the review is published, and then you can get it in the magazine, hopefully within a couple of months. It takes that long from the time you give it to them until it goes, but that's my opinion of best evidence. Now, three stories are in the news that I want to cover in detail, and maybe I'll get back to those. Maybe I won't this evening because I want to concentrate on one main story, one part, like an octopus that fits in one of the branches of this conspiracy body that's coming unglued right now. So I'm going to pass up stories that I've been doing on the Wells Fargo embezzlement case in Los Angeles. That continues to be one of the biggest stories in the country. It's made the front pages of the New York Times finally. It was on Section D of the sports section, 2-inch column. Remember, way back it started. Now it's at the front page, and the person writing the article, the February 23rd, 1981, is Jeff Gerth. He did that monumental work in Sundance a few years ago on Richard Nixon and the Mafia. I should have those copied and reprinted for people that don't have that. He's a very alert person, and I called Jeff Gerth in Washington, D.C., to ask him if he was aware of the possibility that the Wells Fargo bank missing $21 to $23 to $680 million linked now to the Japanese mafia and other tentacles that are very elusive but come loud and clear, the Florida connections, the Century City connections, Caesar's Palace in Vegas, and so forth. He was not aware of those connections, and I told him that this week I would send him a diagram of those. Also, the Los Angeles Times had to break with a front-page story and a full-page February 26th. They call their story, Wells Fargo is the victim of a simple plan. The bank chairman said one man acted alone in scheming the missing of $21.3 million. But the article goes on with all kinds of evasions and unanswered questions of bank policies and how the money was gone and where it went. And they're discounting the link of it to millions of dollars that have gone to Tennessee. Or the Hollywood branch, there's a gentleman that runs the Hollywood branch that was fired. They're discounting any connections to Gene Kawakami, but Jeff Gerth told me that Kawakami was in Australia on trips with Harold Smith from the Beverly Hills branch. So the Beverly Hills offices have to be lying about what they're saying, but it is making the front page story, and that's important. Another article, the LA Times, money gurus' followers face loss of millions, and those are the Tennessee connections to the bank, and I'll go into that again. probably next week. And linking probably to that story again, remember the spy who left Lompoc prison recently, the escaped spy, Christopher Boyce? Well, he's running a cocaine ring down in Palos Verdes Estates in Southern California, which is where Mr. Kawakami and Mr. Fisher and the Vegas gang that are linked to the Wells Fargo scandal. He was a man that worked with the KGB, and he worked with the CIA, and he was accused of giving the KGB information. But this is one of these famous escapes that was allowed to happen. Mr. Christopher Boyce is working between the United States and Mexico. He's in on cocaine problems, which involve, cocaine traffic out of the Wells Fargo Bank, cocaine traffic out of the Nugan Hand Bank in Australia, trips of these people to Australia. And this man is working with the KGB and was arrested for that. He's out at the Palos Verdes Department. The Palos Verdes police know where he is, and it's the Palos Verdes Estates where the official from the Wells Fargo Bank lives. Involves cocaine, the KGB, and the CIA. And I imagine that the CIA agent that Christopher Boyce worked had something to do with John Paisley and Lee Harvey Oswald, because the money out of the Nugan Hand Bank, the CIA bank in Australia, has to do with John Paisley and Lee Harvey Oswald's trips to the Soviet Union. So I'm still charting, like I mentioned last week, this story, the allegations of Harold Smith of the Japanese mafia involved, William Colby, the lawyer for the Nugan Hand representatives, the head of the CIA when it was putting heroin and cocaine money into the CIA bank. Colby left the CIA to become a lobbyist for Japanese firms. So we have a can of worms of the Wells Fargo Bank in Beverly Hills, this Christopher Boyce story in the Palos Verdes Estates, cocaine operations, and the Nugan Hand money missing. And that is a very big story. And also on our own dear Monterey Peninsula, the story is closing in, and I'm drawing diagrams of that too, because 20th Century Fox was just sold this week to a man, a buddy of Frank Sinatra's, front page story of our Herald today, and Sinatra's gang have bought 20th Century Fox along. Gerald Ford was a director on there along with Grace Kelly. 20th Century Fox owns Pebble Beach, and there's a lot of Japanese money coming into Big Sur area, and of course Hayakawa, who's very close to this group, has been instrumental in stopping the federal government from, in quotes, protecting Big Sur so the private developers could come in. So our entire Monterey Peninsula will change face with this big transaction. And again, Sinatra just got a hold of Caesar's Palace, got reinstated his lifelong dream since the 60s to be in charge of Caesar's Palace. And Caesar's Palace is linked to the Wells Fargo clique. So just vaguely, again, these stories of the selling of 20th Century Fox, the Nugan Hand money, the Wells Fargo Bank, and the Christopher Boyce story are hanging in there with interlocking possible connections that I'm following. But I do want to pass that up. Just run it down. I'm throwing out a lot of names to you. I'll get back to them later, because I want to go into a story that I talked about briefly, described in the San Francisco Chronicle, in quotes, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police in Vancouver uncovered the headquarters of the international crime conglomerate with their headquarters in San Francisco. Now, that's a pretty big order. We're talking about also my fears that the Nugan Hand funded the SLA in Jonestown and a lot of San Francisco violence coming out of the San Francisco Police Department, the prison systems, and so forth. So I'm watching San Francisco carefully. But this story is called The International Crime Conglomerate with its base in San Francisco. It's international crime. Now, some of these stories, in order to find the CIA or the DEA connections, you have to comb through years and years or months of little articles. But the way this story broke, January the 11th, 1981, in the San Francisco Examiner Chronicle, was CIA is linked to the curious case of the mystery of the disappearing actress, the CIA. Very seldom does the CIA get a headline when the case first breaks. You have to eke it out. And there were stories in the San Francisco Chronicle and Examiner. No other newspapers that I take. I take 10 a day, and most of these I'm getting clippings from a subscriber to the tapes who follows them every week and plays these broadcasts on other stations in Northern California. My editions of the paper coming down here don't even have this, the ones that come to Carmel, the same day. And he's mailing these articles. And as of this date, there's only been about 8 or 9 articles, even though the headline entry story was the CIA is linked. And then part of the story is the headquarters of International Crime Conglomerate. Well, down in Australia, you see the CIA is linked to, according to the New York News and Joe Volz and the story I read to you on the air, is linked to the International Crime Syndicate, too. So will these two meet in San Francisco? Now, the headline stories of this item began January the 11th on the CIA. January 16th, the San Francisco Examiner said, "Dangerous ex-con is set free. Judge is baffled by the leaky system that lets a dangerous man go." On the 17th, the Examiner said, "Ex-con is back in custody after an uproar over bail." On January the 18th, "A crime genius, a master plan, a genius plan robberies from a base in Canada. This is a man who's been trained in fluent Japanese and speaks Japanese," and again, the Japanese mafia connection coming into this. Another story on the 19th, "Clues found in a warehouse, hint the murder of a San Francisco woman." Then another article on the 20th, "Ex-convict is freed on $5,000 bail." And the next article was that the district attorney in San Francisco, Arlo Smith, they tried to kick off to the case. They said a bid to out Arlo Smith in the mystery case. And then another article, "A masterful crime, turning loot into guns. The plan is uncovered, linked to an actress's disappearance." And the punchline, of course, is guns by the CIA and narcotics traffic for El Salvador that the United States and General Haig are accusing the Russians of sending in. Another article on the McDonald file. And then after February the 6th, that's almost a month ago, I haven't seen a single update of the story. The first story that broke where the CIA was linked to the case has to do with an actress, not a very well-known actress, by the name of Valerie McDonald. She disappeared November the 9th, this last November. On November the 26th, a man, Michael Hennessy, who was linked to her disappearance, was murdered in Trail, Canada, in British Columbia, by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And January the 1st, 1981, just 2 months after her murder, a woman, Inez Saylor, a woman from Germany, who had just arrived in the San Jose area, had been to Canada and New Mexico, interestingly enough. She was there just a month before the riots or the breakouts there when the CIA man became head of the prison in New Mexico. She worked at a Japanese bedding store in San Francisco, in the Japanese part of town, another connection possibly to the one gentleman speaking fluent Japanese. And anyway, this woman from Germany had the name of the actress who had been murdered before in her possession. Valerie McDonald had gone to the University of Oregon. She went to the San Francisco Art Institute. It was working as an actress in San Francisco. Now, the San Francisco Chronicle, who they usually put things very lightly, had this to say in quotes, "What went on before, between, and since Valerie McDonald's death forms part of a Byzantine puzzle that leads to police of two countries, a puzzle that grows in size and changes in shape the longer it lies in pieces." We've got two countries, we've got police, we have the CIA, Byzantine puzzle. The Chronicle went on, "The pieces include a criminal genius named John Abbott. His father works for the United Nations in Rome, Italy. His mother is a professor at the University of California in Davis. They have a gun traced to a former prisoner guard. The guard left San Quentin when three characters were released from San Quentin and had a permit to get the weapons to supply. There are allegations in this first article of links to the Central Intelligence Agency, to the Drug Enforcement Agency, to weapons going to El Salvador, and to right-wing counterinsurgency area. coming out of the San Francisco-Vancouver base. It involves, according to the Chronicle, murders, forgeries, kidnappings, assaults, burglary, possession of stolen property, and attempts to get $1 million for the El Salvador right wing. The first article described an apartment in San Francisco called the Tower Apartment in San Francisco, where Valerie McDonald lived. The new manager of the apartment was only released from San Quentin in August. Her murder took place in November. The assistant manager was John Gordon Abbott, with the high IQ, 160 IQ, and a lot of international connections and trained in Japanese language and so forth. He left San Quentin right after Mr. Thompson left in the fall. And Michael John Hennessy, another assistant manager, was paroled in July of 1980. So the manager of the apartment, the assistant manager, and the second assistant manager were all released from San Quentin prison in the fall of 1980. They'd been picked up with escaping from prison before, stolen weapons, owning weapons, and so forth. And when the three got out, they met up with the prison guard from San Quentin who was supplying new weapons for their operation. John Abbott was described in the Chronicle as brilliant, an IQ of excess of 160. He was involved in one robbery in Davis, California, where his brother was murdered, and he was in for a short time with his buddy, and then he got out. His father is chief marketing economist for the United Nations in Rome, Italy. The mother is a professor at the University of California. I think of Megan Marshak. She's the woman that was with Nelson Rockefeller when he died, and that involved big bucks, too, and her visit to her brother up at Davis. She was quite a heroine at the time. I don't know if there's any connection to the Marshak-Reagan-Colby team up in Davis, but I just, for free thought or free association, throw that out. This Abbott was arrested in 1978 for $250,000 for art objects, jewelry, caches of automatic weapons. And the men were involved in at least three robberies, the San Francisco Chronicle said. They were tied to at least three, but none of them in their jurisdictions ever moved to prosecute them. They were only in on one rap, and they were let out to manage this apartment where they were all to get together later. But there were three other known robberies they were allowed to take part in, and there was never any effort to pin them down or prosecute them. Abbott and Thompson have gotten off many times, in other words. Mrs. Abbott said they were attempting to get together. This is the wife of John Abbott, who's now arrested in British Columbia. They were getting together $1 million bankroll to deliver to right-wing counterinsurgency group in El Salvador. Now, it's interesting that she said that when the headline story of the first story says CIA linked to the disappearing actress, and the wife of one of the men arrested said the purpose was to send it to El Salvador, and the article lists associates the case with the DEA and the CIA. And it goes on to say John Abbott was not only a genius, he spoke Japanese fluently, studied Asian history, knows about anything you would ever want to know. So I wonder how long or if he spent time in Japan when he didn't serve time for the burglaries and the art objects and the other arrests that he got away from. Sandra Sutherland, a private investigator for Valerie McDonald's family, said there are links of them with the Federal Drug Enforcement Agency and the CIA, and everywhere we go there is a dead end except the CIA. The McDonald family can't get any help, even though the clothing and the voting registration and the unemployment cards of Valerie McDonald's were found in their possession. No one's been charged with her murder. They found tape and seaweed and cement, cyanide, and all kinds of possessions among these men. One of the men has been killed. Two are alive. And so far, they haven't even been charged for her murder with all of these possessions. The description of the dangerous ex-con that was set free, his name is Philip Thompson, the one that got out of prison to manage the apartment. A woman came with a slip of paper and gave it to the judge. She didn't identify herself and gave it to Judge Louis Garcia after Thompson was picked up and the judge let him go. Abbott and Hennessy were picked up on a fluke in Vancouver at a car agency, and one pulled a gun and the mounted police shot Hennessy and killed him. And in the car was the name of Philip Thompson in San Francisco at Hunter's Point, And when they canvassed the warehouse, that's where they came across files and stockpiles of the intelligence operation. So it was through a fluke that the Royal Canadian Police shot at Hennessy and killed him, and then went into his home, and it led them to San Francisco. Now, this is the end of the first half hour of this tangled web. I'm going back to it in 1 minute. It's Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. We'll take a break and get back to this CIA story with its many connections and mysteries.
This concludes the first half of World Watchers International with Mae Brussel. We will return with the second half after a brief pause.